We're talking about how to safely adopt a pet on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes after news that some dogs from a South Korean meat farm made their way to Wisconsin earlier this year. But first, we are going to take a look at Wisconsin life. Here is producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the NBA playoffs.
Imagine leaving your job, family, and home and moving overseas to Milwaukee to fulfill a dream. That's exactly what Kane Pittman did. Since arriving in Wisconsin, the Australian freelance writer has become one of the few beat reporters for the Milwaukee Bucks. And not a bad year to start covering them. The Bucks are in the playoffs and captured a rare 60 wins this season. I recently talked with Pittman and asked him how he started following a small market team halfway around the world. Turns out, he fell for them the last time the team was this good. And this song was everywhere.
The word around town is we're lighting it up. So who's gonna win it? The Bucks, the Bucks.
So the first NBA game I really watched was when Milwaukee were in the playoffs in 2001. At that point, there wasn't a lot of NBA coverage in Australia at all. So I enjoyed the game, the Bucks won. I really enjoyed watching Ray Allen play it.
Ray Allen, light it up, light it up, man, big dog, light it up, light it up.
I kept following him, I kept following the team, and I've just stuck with him.
You moved from Australia to Milwaukee to cover the Bucks. Why make that journey?
I guess it's kind of crazy, but I've always had this sort of passion in covering sports, but I wasn't doing that in Australia. I was doing other things. I didn't go to college. I went straight to work out of high school. I started my job like 4 days after I finished high school. So it was always something in the background that I would do in my spare time, would do a bit of writing or blogging or whatever you want to say. And then I got myself in the position with this website, The Pick and Roll, which is an Australian basketball website. I was writing for them covering the Australians in the NBA. And we started to have a conversation with my editor that maybe I could come over here and give this a shot and do it for a whole season and see, you know, what comes of that. So I thought that the situation was good for me because I knew Milwaukee were going to be good this year. I'm not sure I knew they were going to be 60 wins good, but I knew they were going to be good. They had a couple of Australians on the team, so I could justify writing for this website and coming to Milwaukee.
So the Bucks are the number one seed in the Eastern Conference. There's a chance that Giannis Antetokounmpo could get MVP. And you and I both know how amazing and impressive this is. But for people who aren't following basketball in Wisconsin, can you help them understand how rare and special this moment is?
Well, just purely if you wanted to look at this team and what they've done this year, so they've won 60 wins. It's the first time the Milwaukee Bucks have done this since 1980, 1981. So it's 38 years. It's only the fifth time in the history of the Bucks that they've won 60 games. They're led by, obviously, Giannis, who is only 24 years old, came to the game late, has grown every single year that he's been in the NBA. And I think the most incredible thing about Giannis is his character and the way that he holds himself, how hard he works, how much he loves his family, the people around him. And for him to win MVP, it would be only the second Milwaukee Bucks player to win an MVP. The way the NBA is at the moment is so balanced to the big markets. The players will head to LA. They will want to play, you know, in the big cities where they believe that they can get more money, more marketing, more endorsement deals. But Giannis and the Bucks have been able to tip that scale and prove that that's not the case, and that's very special, and it's a credit to Giannis, because if the Bucks had any other star, perhaps this isn't the case. But having a guy like Giannis want to be in Milwaukee, stay in Milwaukee, now we're starting to see other players want to be in Milwaukee because of this one star that says, hey, this is a good place to play, this is good people here, we have a brand new arena now, the front office looks after you, they're good people. Now they're potentially bringing a title to Milwaukee for the first time since 1971. So it's what we've seen from Milwaukee is not, it's amazing.
The Bucks are what's hot, there's no need to deny. So what we gonna do? Let it fly, let it fly.
Kane Pittman is a writer from Australia covering the Milwaukee Bucks. He is currently job hunting and would love to stay in Milwaukee. The Bucks are facing the Detroit Pistons this week in the NBA playoffs. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Eric Bledsoe, let it fly, let it fly. Splash Mountain, let it fly, let it fly.
Greek Free,
let it fly, let it fly.
Cause who's gonna win it?
The Bucks, let it fly.
President Brogdon,
let it fly, let it fly.
Cash Money,
let it fly, let it fly.
The whole squad,
let it fly, let it fly.
Cause who's gonna win it?
The Bucks, let it fly.
Milwaukee,
we.
Milwaukee,
we.
Milwaukee,
we.
Let it fly, let it fly.
You're with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're having some difficulties with our phones this morning. But later this hour, we're going to be looking at Earth Day and Wisconsin's leadership on Earth Day and what happens next for environmental stewardship. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And UW-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies is kicking off the Year of the Environment today. It is a year-long celebration of the historic success of Earth Day and Wisconsin's environmental leadership and our legacy when it comes to Earth Day. We are going to be talking later this hour with U.S. Senator Russ Feingold, who served as a U.S. Senator from Wisconsin from 1993 to 2011. We're also going to be talking with environmental activist Tia Nelson, who will be here in studio. She is director of the Outrider Foundation's climate program and former executive secretary of the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands in Wisconsin. She is also the daughter of former Governor and Senator Gaylord Nelson, who founded Earth Day. And later this hour, we're going to be asking you the significance of Earth Day to you, and perhaps you're going to the kickoff of the Earth Day, the Year of the Environment, a celebration leading up to Earth Day in 2020, the 50th anniversary. And if Earth Day means a lot to you, what are you thinking about on this day? So we'll be talking with environmental activist Tia Nelson. We'll be talking with former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold, who will join us to talk about the kickoff of the Year in the Environment. And that's a year-long celebration that leads up to the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, which will be held in 2020, as we are in the 49th year of Earth Day. We're going to ask you, what do you do to mark Earth Day? And when you consider the state of Wisconsin's environmental ethic, what changes have you seen and what is there to improve? As we look at Earth Day here, we're going to be looking at it on the morning show and talking about bipartisan efforts in environmental stewardship. We'll have former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold and environmentalist Tia Nelson with us as we look at our state's environment and legacy. And that is coming up here in just a few minutes or so, about halfway through the hour, we'll be looking at Earth Day here on the morning show. So stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The hit HBO series Game of Thrones started its eighth and final season last night. Joanna Robinson writes about the show for Vanity Fair and thinks Game of Thrones has worked its way into the pop culture mainstream in a way we're not likely to see again. And here she is joining WPR's Chris Molina to explain and chat about the show's success and the challenge of ending the show in a way that satisfies viewers. Let's take a listen.
Joanna, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, what is your excitement level for the Game of Thrones premiere this weekend?
Oh, gosh, it's probably a 9. Let's, like, save one number just in case, but mostly at a 9.
So the last time I remember people being this excited for a television event was probably in 2013 when there were the final few episodes of Breaking Bad. Now, Game of Thrones fans know why they're excited about this show on Sunday. Others might be wondering, well, what's the big deal? Can you explain why there's so much excitement for this?
Yeah, I would say not only for the people who've been watching the show for the better part of the last decade are excited to see how it all ends. You know, it's 6 final episodes. Some of them are movie length and promise to be epic and amazing and all of that. But there's also, you have to consider the book readers who have been reading this book series that George R. R. Martin started in 1991, I think it was, early 90s. So decades, they've been wondering how this story ends. And they're finally going to get the answer to that. It might be, you know, on screen, maybe they prefer to have it on the page, but they'll finally have the answers. And so they're really excited for that.
But there's no way, though, that there's going to be one ending that makes everybody happy, though, right? I mean, you've got book readers who have been with the series for a long time. You've got TV viewers who have come to it maybe more recently. We've all got our theories. Is there any way that the show can stick the landing?
I think the stick the landing question is really interesting because that definition differs for so many people, you know? And so I've talked to a lot of the people who work on the show, and they've all said, we're aware that people are worried about the finale. We're aware that we're so big that there's no way people aren't going to look at this and think they didn't quite satisfy all my needs. But I think what I really admire about the people who work on this show is they've said they're not going to let that stop them from swinging for the fences. And so from what I understand, the final season of Game of Thrones is not being made with the fear that people won't like it. It's being made with the idea that the show started with, which is they're going to surprise you. They're going to shock you. They're going to maybe upset you in some ways. And I'm kind of excited for that. I'm excited for the ending to anger some people because then we're going to have this big conversation about it. That's going to be really fun.
So I want to figure out how we got here in the first place. I mean, at its core, Game of Thrones is a fantasy show. We've got dragons. You've got direwolves. You've got essentially ice zombies. So in the past, these are not the elements of your typical television show that has mass appeal, and yet this is a show that is in the pop culture mainstream now. What happened?
Yeah, I think what you have to remember, this is something that executive producer of the show, Brian Cogman, told me, and I really loved it. He says, if you look at the first episode of Game of Thrones, it's just about one guy going to his friend's house for dinner and their family's meeting. Like, that's how he thinks of the first episode of Game of Thrones.
He was good with a spear as he used to be.
No, but I'm still better than you.
You know, and it's just sort of like old war buddies. And so if you look at the character of this show, like the zombies, the dragons, the magic, the resurrection, all of that gets sort of seeded in later. And it starts with character and it starts with real relatable stories. And so I think a lot of people were put off at first or just unsure that the show is for them. I remember a really scathing New York Times review, you know, dismissing the show as sort of silly fantasy or something like that. But over time, especially with the various twists and turns that George R. R. Martin had written into his story early on, the reaction, the emotional reaction it incited in viewers was hard to ignore. So when you have something like season 3, The Red Wedding happens, even if you don't watch Game of Thrones, you've maybe heard the phrase Red Wedding. When that happens and all these reaction videos, these genuine reaction videos go viral.
No, 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 no!
Oh, no! Oh! Oh, really?
Did you guys know about this?
Then people start to perk up and pay attention, and they're like, what is this show that is causing people to scream and cry in their living rooms? And maybe I want to watch it too. And so you just see the audience build over time as people realize that though the dragons and the ice zombies and all of that is part of the show, it's not the core of the show.
Is it kind of amazing that this model that Game of Thrones is using, this idea that you're still waiting for one episode a week versus what's happening elsewhere in pop culture where content producers are eager just to drop seasons in your lap? Is it kind of amazing that this model still exists and that we're still just going crazy for it week after week?
Yeah, and I actually wish people who use the binge model, which is almost all digital streamers now, your Amazons, your Netflixes, et cetera, would pay attention to how much power a show has when we get to watch it week by week and spend weeks at least talking about one story altogether versus, you know, even the most popular show on Netflix, you know, people watch it at different times. You'll binge watch it in a day. Your friend binge watched it a week later. So you're sort of out of sync. You can't talk about it week by week versus Monday morning, you go into work and you go to, oh my God, Game of Thrones last night. That was amazing. And that's what's sad about the end of Game of Thrones, you know, more than even that story going away is that moment going away in our culture, because the binge model is so popular now and the TV landscape is so crowded now. Everyone's attention is so split and fractured that there's no, you know, one show we're all watching together week by week, having these slightly slower conversations about it. And I don't think there's going to be anything to replace Game of Thrones in that arena when it goes away.
Right. I mean, it's hard to remember it now. Back in the dark ages of 2011, I mean, TV streaming was just kind of coming into its own. We were right in the middle of like Mad Men and Breaking Bad. There were a lot fewer prestige television shows to come up with. And, you know, in the future, we're not going to be without Game of Thrones. There's going to be some form of Game of Thrones in our lives. There is at least one prequel in the works that's going to start filming this summer. There's talk of anywhere from like 1 to 4 more of them. But I'm wondering if, because of this changed model, if any of these shows are going to be able to catch that lightning in a bottle twice, or if the model is just permanently changed at this point.
I think it's permanently changed. I mean, I wish the prequels well, and I think they will do well if there are more than one. I think that one will do well. It sounds great. Great creative team, great cast. I'm really excited to see it. I don't think it has any chance of touching like the popularity or the cultural power of the original Game of Thrones, and that's not a knock on it. It's just the fact, even the pure fact that HBO was recently acquired by AT&T, and those new owners have said they're going to increase the content on HBO by 50% by the end of the year. And so we're used to HBO having its few shows on Sunday nights, and that sort of means something. An HBO show means hand-selected, value, elite, sort of prestige kind of thing. And now they're just going to flood the gates to try to keep up with Apple and Amazon and Netflix. And that means the power of what an HBO show is itself goes away. And so I think that not only are the prequel series, however many there may be, will not be able to match Game of Thrones, but all these other networks that are trying to do big, splashy fantasy adaptations, like Amazon's got Lord of the Rings, they've got Wheel of Time, HBO's doing His Dark Materials, someone's doing In the Name of the Wind. Like, they're chasing exactly what Game of Thrones was, but I think, as we saw when Lost went off the air, all these other shows tried to be Lost, exactly Lost. And the next Lost wasn't exactly like Lost. The next Lost was like Game of Thrones. You know, so you can't just copy paste what we had before. The culture changes. You need something different this time.
So let's talk about the final episode now. And, you know, we kind of talked about the pressure to really stick the landing. And I think we hear this all the time with shows, that a show can be absolutely great, but everyone's always going to remember that last episode. Like, Seinfeld was a great show. The finale sucked. So in your world, in your view, what needs to happen in this finale to make it not suck?
Like I said before, I think it needs to try to be as true to the spirit in which the show started, which is no cozy happy ending, that some shows think that they have to give you, put a bow and a happy ending on something. And I don't think Game of Thrones wants to or needs to do that. I want it to give us something that feels morally murky and complex. I want us to be arguing over who was right.
You wish to know where my true loyalties lie? Not with any king or queen, but with the people. The people who suffer under despots and prosper under just rule. The people whose hearts you aim to win.
Swear this to me, Varys. If you ever think I'm failing the people, you won't conspire behind my back. You'll look me in the eye as you have done today, and you'll tell me how I'm failing them.
I swear it, my queen.
And I swear this. If you ever betray me, I'll burn you alive.
I would expect nothing less from the Mother of Dragons.
And so that's what I want. There's an easy way to end this, right? Which is, Jon and Daenerys by matching Iron Thrones. they sit side by side in King's Landing and raise a bunch of kids and direwolf puppies and dragon babies and, you know, whatever it is. Like, that's the ending I do not want. That ending, in my opinion, sucks. But, you know, give me something weird and dark and that leaves you feeling kind of like, oh, huh. That's how I want Game of Thrones to end.
So in a way, it almost doesn't matter who gets to sit on the Iron Throne at the end, but what does matter is the fact that we get to fight online about it for like the next 6 months.
Yes. More fighting. Yes.
Well, Joanna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
We're talking about Wisconsin's leadership on Earth Day and what happens next for environmental stewardship. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies kicks off the Year of the Environment today. It's a year-long celebration of the historic success of Earth Day and Wisconsin's environmental leadership and legacy. Tia Nelson is director of the Outrider Foundation's climate program and former executive secretary of the Board of Commissioners of Public Lands in Wisconsin. She is the daughter of former Governor and Senator Gaylord Nelson, who founded Earth Day. Tia, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, good morning. It's good to be here.
So this year kicks off the Year of the Environment as we lead up to 2020 and 50 years of Earth Day. Tia, what are your hopes for Wisconsin this year as we lead up to that 50-year mark?
Well, my hope is that we work together to restore the long bipartisan tradition the state has in protecting the rights to breathe clean air and drink clean water and use our public land. We have a long tradition here, and I would like to see a restoration of that tradition and protection of those rights for all Americans, all Wisconsinites.
What do you think your father would say about this upcoming 50-year mark if he could go back in time?
Well, I get asked that question a lot, yeah. As you might imagine. I think he would be inclined to tell you that we've come a really long way, that he would remind people that in 1970, the first Earth Day, there was no environmental protection agency looking after our rights to breathe clean air and drink clean water, that we've come a long way. The environmental decade that was launched at the first Earth Day, more laws were adopted to protect our environment than any other time in American history. A Republican president created the Environmental Protection Agency. In 1972, there was not a single no vote in the amendments to the Clean Air Act, not a single one. And so I think he'd tell you we've come a long ways, but we have a really big challenge in front of us now today. We have a crisis around the issue of climate change. We have the opportunity to address that crisis to create a strong economy and a livable planet for the human species and other life forms. And it's a big challenge, and I think he would be calling people to action.
I was looking at the history. There are 192 countries that observe Earth Day, more than a billion people observing Earth Day. And going back to some of those initial efforts to start an Earth Day, apparently he set a date in April because there perhaps wouldn't be snow in April for sit-ins on campuses.
Yeah, it's, well, the how he picked the date, he was trying to sort of calibrate when the weather would be good, when students wouldn't be in exam time. It was critical, of course, that he pay attention to what was happening on campuses, because the whole inspiration for Earth Day came from the college anti-war teach-ins that were occurring across the country, and he saw how they affected the national discourse on the issue of the Vietnam War. And so he was doing a call to action for college campuses and K-12 schools, and he wanted to be sure the kids could get outside and use their voice, you know?
Mm. What is your memory about his passion for conservation and also the creation of a day to really think about it and do something about it?
Well, it's interesting. If you asked my father, as he was frequently asked, you know, to what he would attribute his passion for the environment, he would say something to the effect of it was imbued in him. Nature was his playground. He grew up in Clear Lake in Polk County, northwest of Eau Claire. Nature was his playground, and it was imbued in him from a very early age. And the really interesting thing to me is I go through photographs of my father with my grandfather, or my father as a child in Clear Lake, the places my grandfather took my father to visit, the Apostle Islands, the St. Croix River, which they fished and canoed and camped, these became the places that he sought to preserve and protect and conserve as governor and U.S. senator after he grew up. So his childhood experiences recreating and being in nature in Wisconsin was a big part of his inspiration.
Mm. When you look back, what have Wisconsin's successes been when it comes to the environment? Can you see any highlights beyond establishing Earth Day?
Sure. We have the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund, which is used to conserve the lands and waters that make Wisconsin special. That fund is named after a Republican, Warren Knowles, who succeeded my father as governor, and my father. It started out, my father began the program as governor. It was the Outdoor Recreation Action Program was its name, and it was funded by a penny a pack tax on cigarettes. And it has endured throughout many decades and remains today a critical part of conserving land and water in Wisconsin. And that's a great bipartisan legacy I'm quite proud of.
We're talking with environmentalist Tia Nelson as we kick off the Year of the Environment. It's a year-long celebration leading up to the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, which will be in 2020. Kicks off today on the 49th anniversary of Earth Day. Tia, it seems like every day we hear about new challenges to the environment, microplastics in our water, the possibility of decreased funding for research and conservation for the Great Lakes, pollution from lead pipes. What would you say are the major challenges our state is facing right now when it comes to the environment?
Well, certainly the biggest environmental challenge we face here in Wisconsin and around the country, and indeed around the world, is the climate change crisis. The interesting thing is a big part of solving that issue, a big part of solving the climate change challenge really boils down to simple stuff. Stop wasting energy, improve energy efficiency, stop destroying rainforest, stop wasting food. Who knew that if food waste were a country, it would be the third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the world after the U.S. and China. So that's something that every individual can be a part of helping address. So climate change is the biggest environmental challenge. We have significant drinking water issues in Wisconsin, that would also be high on the list.
Well, I'm going to pause right here. I believe U.S. Senator Russ Feingold is on the line.
I am.
Oh, good. Good to have you here. thank you so much for joining us. So sorry about our technical difficulties this morning. Senator Feingold, I want to bring you here in and ask you, as this Year of the Environment kicks off, what do you hope for Wisconsin this year, and where do you see bipartisanship on the environment?
Well, thank you. First, happy Earth Day, especially to Tia Nelson, whose father invented it. 49 years ago this day, we were told to go outside at Janesville Craig High School and pick up stuff, pick up bad stuff out there. So I have a distinct memory of the first Earth Day. And there are so many issues, but, you know, even though I wasn't on the line, I was able to hear a little bit there of Tia talking about the climate change issue, which is just overriding. But, you know, there are other issues that are extremely important, such as the enormous challenge to biodiversity around the world. These two issues are interrelated, but the loss of life throughout the world, all kinds, plants, life in the marine environment, terrestrial environment, this is a great threat to the extent that some people are talking about something called the sixth extinction. So, you know, yes, of course, Tia and I both really hope for bipartisanship on those issues. But, you know, we have issues in Wisconsin that have always been more bipartisan. You know, having clean lakes, freshwater lakes around the state, making sure you don't have runoff in a way that threatens a drinking water supply is an issue I've heard so much about in the last few years. And I really believe, since those are just fundamental things that every Wisconsinite cares about, not to mention being able to hunt and fish and have a good environment for that, you know, I'm hoping, though, that this year, this special year, will be the beginning of a turnaround, get away from the partisanship and get back to the kind of friendships and relationships that Gaylord Nelson always had.
Senator Feingold, you were the U.S. Special Envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo between 2013 and 2015. When you think about the environmental challenges our freshwater bodies face, both in the U.S., in Wisconsin, and elsewhere, what are those specific challenges?
Well, we have similar challenges to the people in the enormous Great Lakes region of Africa. In fact, Susan Hedman, a Wisconsinite, who was at the EPA, and I used our opportunity to have those positions to create a conference, bring together the experts on the Great Lakes of our area of the world, in the northern United States and Canada, with the experts with regard to the Great Lakes of Africa, huge lakes like Lake Tanganyika. And it was a fantastic conference in Lake Tanganyika, but specifically we realized we had similar issues, climate change issues, issues of overfishing, issues of sanitary water for people to drink and use for cooking and eating. So the issues are very similar, invasive species, and we have a lot to learn from each other. And so there's a really strong international element to this that the Nelson Institute is a leader on, nationally and internationally.
And so when you think about clean water, you really have to look globally and think globally about our neighbors halfway across the world to perhaps understand what you're doing close to home.
If you want to be effective, I mean, I think something like 20% of all the fresh water in the world is in these Great Lakes, and another 20% is in those Great Lakes. So we have a special responsibility when it comes to fresh water and the issues that affect the populations and the environment and the biodiversity there. So, yes, absolutely.
We're talking about Earth Day in Wisconsin and the bipartisan efforts in environmental stewardship. Former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold and environmentalist Tia Nelson stay with us as we look at our state's environmental legacy and its future. And we'll be back in just a moment to continue this conversation right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about Earth Day in Wisconsin and environmental stewardship for the future. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earth Day is observed in 192 countries, celebrated by more than a billion people every year. We're looking at the bipartisan efforts that led to its development, including those of Earth Day founder and Nelson Institute namesake Gaylord Nelson. We're talking with environmental activist Tia Nelson and former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold about the state's environmental leadership. And Tia, when you think about the disconnect that exists in broader conversations about conservation and climate change, where do we have room to grow? Where do we have room to come together?
Well, I think environmentalists in general have missed a really important piece of this conversation, and that in thinking about this, we have great opportunity to change how we have the conversation around the environment. I would argue that the right to breathe clean air and drink clean water is a fundamental right that government is required, that our expectation should be for government to protect those rights, just as we expect government to keep our community safe or protect our national security. There's been too much, in my view, too much framing of the issue as one of gloom and doom. I think the opportunity that you're asking about is really the opportunity to help people envision a brighter future and to give them a means by which they can be a part of making that brighter future happen. I believe in the infinite imagination of the human species and our ability to solve problems and to make the world a better place. And I think the challenge before us now is to envision a future that we want to live in and for people to recognize that we all have a role to play in building that future.
Senator Feingold, it seems like Tia is saying there is room for everyone at this table. There's room for opportunity to change, to solve problems here. What needs to happen when it comes to education about the environment and what people can do in their own lives?
Well, I can give you a story about Gaylord for me. Obviously, Tia has the main stories. But, you know, when I was lucky enough to be elected to the United States Senate, I called Gaylord and thanked him for his support. And, you know, he just got right down to business. He said, Russ, you need to get rid of that 1872 mining law. And why did he say that? Because it was a giveaway to, you know, sort of the robber barons of the mining industry and being able to exploit federal lands. But the point about it is it combined environmentalism with fiscal responsibility, with making sure we weren't wasting our tax dollars. So you see that. That brings together things that some might look more as progressive on the left side with a more conservative side. And he understood that. He understood that people in Wisconsin especially, but everywhere, really like it when you can talk about fiscal responsibility as well as responsibility for the planet. So I think making those kinds of arguments, in addition to the wonderful kinds of comments that Tia made, is helpful on the day-to-day basis in a legislature, whether it's in the state or the Congress or even on a county board.
Well, fiscal responsibility, too, it can be really tricky because oftentimes in order to make change for the environment, it is going to require funds. It's going to require something from the coffers at some point. Is that more difficult in today's age to be able to find the dollars necessary for the environment?
Well, you have to cut through the rhetoric on this. Naturally, the rhetoric is going to be that it's, you know, too hard to deal with climate issues because it costs so much. But, you know, I'm overlooking Pheasant Branch Creek in Middleton, where we're lucky enough to live. And last August, there was this horrific rainstorm, as we all know. Mm. And think about the costs that this community and this county is going through right now of trying to restore this beautiful area, because the climate has become so unusual and so out of control. So truly, if there's anything to cost-benefit analysis, being serious about the climate, being serious about biodiversity issues and others, ultimately has to do with affordability as well as having a planet we can live on.
Tia, today the Nelson Institute for the Environment at UW-Madison is celebrating the 49th anniversary with a series of discussions centered around this theme, Imagine and Adapt Possibilities in a Changing World. What are you looking forward to today in the conference?
Well, I am facilitating a panel on gaming, about which I confess to know almost nothing. What intrigues me about virtual reality and gaming, which is one of the sessions we're having today, is it is a means by which technology can help people imagine and see a future that is unknown to them at this time. So it's a place where one can play in an alternate reality, and through that, all of us have the opportunity to have a sense of what a changing climate means to us wherever we live, and envision ourselves playing a role in solving that. There's a whole series of sessions about adapting in a climate-changing world, and I'm really excited about it. I'm extremely grateful to Russ, and unfortunately, former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson couldn't be with us today, but he and Russ have agreed to be the honorary co-chairs of this effort and do their part to restore the bipartisan conversation around these challenges. I'm sorry Tommy can't be with us, but I did get a nice note from him last night wishing us well today. So we've got a bunch of different sessions, and I'm really excited about it. It's an annual tradition. My father certainly wouldn't have imagined when he first came up with the idea of a teach-in that it would endure as it does today. It's such a significant part of his legacy.
And your work today on the Outrider Foundation, specifically on climate change, what are you working on today?
We're working on creating awareness and inspiring action. The project that I'm most excited about for 2019 is we're creating a series of what we call social first, meaning designed for social media, short form videos that talk about climate solutions, single use plastic, food waste, smart thermostats in the home. Join the Citizen Climate Lobby, a great bipartisan organization with membership in every congressional district in the country, promoting a very common sense solution to climate change that doesn't cost a lot of money and doesn't require complicated bureaucracy. There are a whole series of things we can do, and we're telling those stories through these short-form videos. I'm also super excited to welcome Brent Suter, the pitcher of the Milwaukee Brewers, as Outrider's new sports ambassador. And I've been working a bit with Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, one of the world's renowned climate scientists and an evangelical Christian, about the intersection of faith, the environment, and climate change, to help bring more people into the conversation and help them imagine themselves being a part of a brighter future. So it's all about figuring out how to tell those stories and engage, inspire, inform.
Senator Feingold, we've been talking about Wisconsin's legacy, but what about its future? What do you envision as we go forward when we talk about Earth Day, when we talk about Wisconsin, policy on the environment?
Well, my vision is that we get back to the sense of community and bipartisanship that Gaylord Nelson and Warren Knoll showed, that actually Tommy Thompson often showed as governor. And that's why I'm so happy that first thing to kick off the conference today, I'll be having a sort of fireside chat with Congressman Tim Petri, who is a longtime Republican congressman from a very Republican part of the state. We're going to talk about how Gaylord and the politicians in that era were able to work together always when it came to what was called then conservation or the environment. So I'm hoping that points the way and shows people it's not just the right thing to do. It can be fun, and you can get stuff done. So that's my hope. That's the tone we're going to try to set.
Senator Feingold, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Russ Feingold is a distinguished visiting lecturer at the UW-Madison, former Wisconsin and U.S. Senator. And Tia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Make every day Earth Day.
Tia Nelson directs the Outrider Foundation's climate program, is the daughter of former Governor and Senator Gaylord Nelson, who founded Earth Day 49 years ago. The Nelson Institute for Environmental Sciences Earth Day Conference starts at 9 this morning. Registration is still available. Details about the conference can be found on the morning show page at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.